Fundamental of Buddhism is taught by Venerable Sayadaw Usilananda at the Tathagata Meditation Center, San Jose, California, on March 27, 1998.
We have been talking about the spiritual path in Buddhism. So the first is taking refuge and then the practice of sila or moral purity, and then practice of samadhi or concentration, that is the practice of samatha meditation. So today we come to the next stage or next step in spiritual path, and this is the path of wisdom. Samadhi or concentration is good to develop, but samadhi alone is not enough to gain enlightenment. So in order to gain enlightenment, in order to make an end of suffering, we must practice what is called panya or wisdom. And in order to practice wisdom, we practice vipassana meditation. You have been practicing vipassana meditation for many years, and so you know how to practice. But tonight I will talk about theoretical vipassana. Vipassana in theory. As it is a course on fundamentals of Buddhism, I have to include vipassana in this course. But actually, since you have been practicing vipassana, you don't need to be told about vipassana. The meaning of the word vipassana. The word vipassana is translated in English as insight meditation. It is translated as insight meditation probably because vipassana gives insight into the true nature of mind and matter. But the literal meaning of the word vipassana is a little different. So you should know the literal meaning also. The literal meaning of the word vipassana is seeing in many ways. The word vipassana is composed of vi and passana. It's a two parts. Vi is a prefix with many meanings, and here it means in many ways. And passana is a verbal noun meaning seeing. So vipassana means seeing in many ways. And here in many ways means seeing mind and matter, or seeing the five aggregates, or seeing the conditioned phenomena as impermanent, suffering, and not so. So as the name implies, when you practice vipassana, you must see the impermanent, suffering, and not so nature of the object you observe. Only when you see these three characteristics can you see truly that you are practicing vipassana meditation. And Vipassana meditation was discovered by the Buddha and taught by him to all beings. You know, he was practicing austerities in the forest for almost 6 years. But towards the end of the 6th year, he was still far away from his goal. So he reviewed his practice and he came to the conclusion that that practice was wrong. And then he discovered the middle way, which is the practice of Vipassana. And he practiced it and he got the best results of that practice. That is, he became the Buddha. And for 4 to 5 years after his enlightenment as the Buddha, he taught many things, and he taught many times the Vipassana or Satipatthana meditation. So Vipassana can be understood and can be practiced only when there is a Buddha in the world, or when his teachings are still available in the world. Whether during the dispensation of the Buddha or not, people can practice Samatha meditation. But only during the dispensation of the Buddha can people practice Vipassana meditation. And Vipassana meditation only can lead to the penetration of the true nature of mind and matter, and to the realization of the Four Noble Truths. During the time of the Buddha, and also about 1,000 years after his death, Vipassana seemed to be practiced by many people. But after about 1,000 years after the death of the Buddha, until recently, I mean, until the turn of the century, Vipassana seemed to have fallen into disuse. That is because in the commentaries which were written about 1,000 years after the death of the Buddha, we find accounts of people practicing meditation and getting enlightenment. But later, after that, the instances of people practicing meditation and getting enlightenment became rare. So Mahasisero said that the practice of Vipassana fell into disuse, or not many people practice Vipassana after about 1,000 years. I mean, about 1,000 years after the death of the Buddha, until recently. It does not mean that there were no persons who practiced Vipassana during that time, but it was very rare and very difficult to find a person who practiced Vipassana meditation. And Vipassana meditation was thought to be for only monks, and even monks who lived in forests. So city monks usually did not practice Vipassana. In the ancient records, we find occasional occurrence of those who are supposed to be arahants. And if they were truly arahants, then they must have practiced vipassana meditation. So, although there were very few who practiced vipassana meditation, it was not dead. Practice vipassana meditation in those days, just practice for themselves. And they did not teach vipassana to many people. They taught only to their close pupils or close friends. And so very few people got the opportunity to understand how to practice and then to practice vipassana meditation. About 100 years ago, there was Siados in Burma who tried to revive the practice of vipassana meditation. And the systematic practice of vipassana, as we do now here, I think began with a Seyaro who was known as Mingun Seidowon Seyaro. Now, from his biography, we learned that that Seyaro wanted to practice vipassana meditation, but he did not know how to. So he was searching for a teacher who could teach him vipassana meditation. And fortunately, he met one Seyaro in the place called Mingun. It is across the river from Mandalay. That Seyaro who lived in Mingun was a student of another Seyaro who was reputed or who was renowned as an arahant. But according to the verbal records, that first Seyaro could be a non-returner, because it is said that there was a meeting of many Seyaros one time, and then the other Seyaros asked that Seyaro to give a Dhamma talk to them about the practice. And so he said, I will give you a Dhamma talk as far as my practice goes or something like this. And then he talked about the practice of meditation up till the third stage of enlightenment. So if that record is to be relied, then that Seyaro was an anagami, a non-returner. That Seyaro had not many pupils because he lived in the forest and not many monks could live there. But that Seyaro who lived in Mingun was the student of that first Seyaro. So he knew how to practice, and he practiced, and maybe he is also an enlightened person. So Mingun Seidowon Seyaro met that Seyaro and requested that Seyaro to teach him or to explain to him the practice of meditation. But that Seyaro did not teach him in detail. He just said, there is a discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, and there are commentaries and sub-commentaries. So you just go and study this discourse and commentaries. So Mingun Zirawan Seara studied the discourse along with the commentaries and sub-commentaries, and it is said that he came to know how to practice. And so he practiced. Maybe he got some instructions from that Seara, we don't know. So he practiced, and it is said that he was able to reach some kind of stage, and he was satisfied with his practice. So I think that happened about 1908, so just the turn of the century. After he got satisfaction with his practice, he wanted to teach other people how to practice meditation. So he began giving Dhamma talks at Mingun. But nobody wanted to listen to him. His talks were so strange in those days that people just criticized him and made fun of him. Say, when he talk about knowing I'm going when you are going, I'm sitting when you are sitting. So they made fun of him and said, oh, we also know we are going when you are going. We also know when I'm killing a fish, when I'm killing a fish, and so on. So nobody wanted to hear him. So he went back to his native village because he thought people in his native village, his relatives and others, would want to listen to him. So he went back to his native village and again gave Dhamma talks, and nobody wanted to listen to him, and the same, what do you call that, ridicule he got. So after about 2 years, he went back to Mingun. And again, he was, how to call, persevering. So he again gave talks, and at that time, a couple from Mandalay listened to him, and they were interested, and they wanted to practice meditation under his guidance. So they practiced following his instructions, and they also got satisfaction with their practice. And so, little by little, the number of meditators increased. And later, he was able to establish a meditation center in one town. And that was in 1911. And from that time on, in many towns, the meditation centers were established. And ultimately, in 1914, he went to Lower Burma, to the city of the Thong, and established giving the same name, Mingun Zedawan Monastery there. So he was known as, that is why he was known as Mingun Zedawan Seara. And many people came to him to practice meditation, and so his fame spread far and wide. And he had students or pupils who practiced with him, and then who later on carried on his practice of Vipassana meditation. Now many people, both monks and laymen, went to him to practice meditation, and many many of his students became meditation teachers in his tradition. So one of his pupils, Sayadaw Ubisoda by name, established a center in Rangoon and began teaching Vipassana in the Mingon tradition. And that center is still in existence in Rangoon, not far from the Shwetakon Pagoda. 1932, another student monk went to Mingon Zedewon Searo and practiced meditation under his guidance. And that student monk practiced about 4 months with him, and then he had to go back to his monastery. And that student was the Venerable Mahasi Searo. So Searo, Mahasi Searo, after practicing Vipassana under the guidance of Sedewon Searo, began to teach Vipassana in 1938. So he went back to his native village and gave Dhamma talks, and there were people who wanted to practice meditation, including his cousin brother. So he first taught Vipassana in 1938. And then he went back and forth between the city of the Tone and his native place, which is in Upper Burma. And in 1949, he was invited to Rangoon, Padana Yeda, Rangoon Meditation Center, to teach Vipassana meditation there. And ever since that time, Mahasi Searo lived in the meditation center in Rangoon until his death in 1982. And Mahasi Searo was very successful with spreading Vipassana meditation. And one reason why he was so successful was because he was supported by the then Prime Minister of Burma, U Nu. So when the Prime Minister went to practice meditation to the center, many people go along with him. And so he was very successful in spreading Vipassana meditation, not only in Burma but also abroad, because Mahasi Searo had students, Mahasi Searo had among his students who were conversant with English language, and so his talks and some of his books were translated into English and then distributed abroad, and so people in other countries also got to know about the Mahasi Searo's teachings and his method of Vipassana meditation. And in Burma also, there are, pop up many meditation centers, and thousands of people have practiced meditation Vipassana meditation in those centers. And also in Thailand and in, say, Sri Lanka, meditation centers were established, and many people practiced meditation there too. Now, Mahasi Searo was not the only meditation teacher in Burma. There were many other Searos who taught Vipassana meditation. Although all these Siddhas taught Vipassana meditation, their techniques differ from one another in some respects. But generally, every Siddha who taught Vipassana meditation based their practice on the teachings contained in the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness. Maharishi Sayadaw was invited to the United States to lead retreat and to teach or to give talks on Vipassana meditation by Insight Meditation Society in 1979. So Sayadaw visited this country and led retreats in different places. And when he left me behind to carry on his Vipassana propagation work. And later, now you have other Siddhas teaching Vipassana meditation in the tradition of Maharishi Sayadaw, such as Siddhartha Ubandita, Siddhartha Ukundala, and also Siddhartha Uddhamabhya here. And also in New York, there is Siddhartha Uindaka. So these students of Maharishi Sayadaw are now spreading the practice of Vipassana in this country. Okay. Now we come to the real Vipassana. So please look at the chart. Now the practice of Vipassana is divided into seven stages of purity. In Pali they are called Visuddhi. And a yogi has to go through these seven stages of purity one by one. So there is no skipping of any purity. So you have to go from the beginning up to the top. And during those stages, a Vipassana practitioner experiences different kinds of knowledges or understanding, or different kinds of Vipassana knowledge arise in the mind of a yogi as he or she goes along these seven stages of purity. Now the first stage is called purity of virtue. So during this stage, you do not yet practice Vipassana. You try to purify your moral conduct. Because purity of moral conduct is a firm basis on which you build the structure of concentration and wisdom. Without the moral purity, you cannot hope to get concentration. And if you cannot get concentration, you do not get the penetration into the nature of things. So the purity of virtue or purity of moral conduct is an important step to achieve if you are to practice vipassana meditation, yet meditation, just keeping moral conduct pure. Now, in the middle column, you see keeping Padimokkha precepts and so on. And number one to number four are the kinds of sila or virtue practiced by monks only. Now, this chart is based on the Visuddhimagga, which was written by a monk for monks. And so he did not include sila for lay people. They are not, sila for lay people is not treated in that book. So number five, eight, ten precepts are just put in by me. Precepts, or eight precepts, or 10 precepts. So the minimum requirement is you keep 5 precepts. But if you keep 8 precepts, you get more kusala, more merit, you get more time to devote to the practice of meditation. So keeping 8 precepts is better than keeping 5 precepts. And if you can do away with handling money, you may take 10 precepts, which may be very difficult nowadays. So you may take and keep 5 precepts or 8 precepts or 10 precepts to purify your moral conduct. So the first stage is like making preparation for the practice of meditation. So now second stage of purity is called purity of mind. Purity of mind really means concentration. So excess concentration and absorption concentration are said to be purity of mind, or purity of mind is said to be said to consist of excess concentration and absorption concentration. Now, if a person gets excess concentration and absorption concentration when he practices samatha meditation, he practices one of the samatha meditation and he gets excess concentration and absorption concentration. So in the commentaries, the purity of mind is explained as excess concentration and absorption concentration. Now we are not into vipassana yet. Excess concentration is also called neighborhood concentration, and absorption concentration is called jhana concentration. The first is called neighborhood concentration because it is in the neighborhood of jhana concentration. Now these two concentrations are for those who practice samatha meditation first and then who would change over to vipassana meditation. But there are those who do not practice samatha meditation, who do not begin his meditation practice with samatha meditation, but who practice vipassana meditation right away. So for those people, purity of mind means the third one, momentary concentration. Momentary concentration is similar to excess concentration. Now, when a person gets the excess concentration, he can keep his mind on the meditation object firmly, and there will be no mental hindrances in his mind. So excess concentration can subdue or keep away the mental hindrances, and it could keep the mind on the meditation object firmly. In the same way, momentary concentration can keep the mind on the object, and also it can keep the mental hindrances away from the mind. So momentary concentration is actually a counterpart of excess concentration, or similar to concentration. The only difference between excess concentration and momentary concentration is that for excess concentration, there is only one kind of object. But for momentary concentration, there can be many objects. The objects may differ at different moments for momentary concentration. But for excess concentration, the object is the same kind all through. Although in the commentaries and also in some sub-commentaries, excess concentration and absorption concentration only are said to be purity of mind. But in one sub-commentary to Majjhima Nikaya, the momentary concentration is explained as essential to vipassana meditation. That means if you do not get momentary concentration, then your practice of vipassana will not be successful. So Mahasisyaro explains that for those who practice pure vipassana, for those who do not practice samatha meditation but practice pure vipassana, purity of mind means momentary concentration. So when a person who practices vipassana gets momentary concentration, he is said to have achieved the second stage of purity, purity of mind. So during practice, when your mind is on the meditation object only and it does not wander, then you are said to have obtained the momentary concentration. So when you get momentary concentration, you begin to see the objects clearly. You begin to see or distinguish objects as and this is mind, this is matter, and also you begin to see the characteristic function, manifestation, and proximate cause of the objects. So when you see the objects clearly, when you can distinguish that this is nama and this is rupa, this is mind and this is metta, and when you see the characteristics and others clearly, then you are said to have achieved purity of view. Purity of view means when you watch the objects, you just see that there is an object and there is the mind that takes that object. So just only these two things arising and disappearing, and nothing in addition to these two things, which you can call a self or a soul or an atta. So when you reach this stage, you are able to abandon the wrong view that there is an atta or there is a self or so distinct from or in addition to mind and matter. So at that stage, you are said to gain the knowledge of defining nama, defining mind and matter. After seeing mind and matter clearly and distinctly, you see the causes of mind and matter. You see that something is the cause of mind or something is the cause of matter. And so, at this stage, you are able to overcome doubts. Doubts about whether you had been before or whether you will be in the future, and also doubts about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and and the practice. So this stage, at this stage, you are said to gain the knowledge of discerning causes. Causes may mean sometimes the real causes and sometimes conditions. So you see, at this stage, you see the conditionality of things. Because there is something to be seen, there is the seeing consciousness. Because there is something to be noted, there is the noting consciousness and so on. So you see this clearly at this stage. When a yogi has reached this stage of purity, purity as overcoming doubts, he is called a Chula Sotapanna. He is a lesser stream entrant. That means he is not a real Sotapanna, but he becomes like a Sotapanna. A Sotapanna will not be reborn in the four woeful states in his future births. And this this yogi, a Chula Sotapanna, also will not be reborn in four woeful states in his next rebirth if he does not fall away from this stage. If before his death he falls away from this stage, then his rebirth is not assured. He may be reborn in the four woeful states. So if he does not fall away from this stage until his death, then he will not be reborn in the four woeful states. So he is like a Sotapanna. So he is called a Chula, little Sotapanna or lesser Sotapanna. After discerning the cause of mind and matter, a yogi practices comprehension of the three characteristics. At this stage, he takes objects as a group and then contemplates on them as impermanent, suffering, and not soul. So this stage is called purity of knowledge and vision of path and not path. So at this stage, he gains the knowledge of comprehension. So at this stage, he dwells on many objects and tries to see these objects as impermanent, suffering, and not soul. After comprehending the three characteristics of mind and matter, he comes to see the arising and disappearing of mind and matter, or the arising and disappearing of objects. Now here he sees the arising and disappearing of individual objects. He does not take a group of objects, but he takes each individual object at the moment, and he sees that the object arises and disappears. So when he sees the arising and disappearing of mind and matter, his concentration becomes strong. And when his concentration becomes strong or stronger, he begins to experience what are called impediments of vipassana. So he may experience light, he experiences joy or piti, he experiences tranquility, and he experiences a strong confidence or strong faith, and his effort is strong also, and he experiences sukha, happy, strong also, and he experiences sukha, happiness, and his understanding is very sharp at this moment, and his mindfulness is very firm, and he doesn't have to make much effort to be mindful of the objects. And last, there is the attachment to these impediments. When these impediments arise, he is pleased with these impediments. He likes them and he wanted to hold on to them, and so there is an attachment to these also. And these 10 states are called impediments of vipassana, because when a yogi experiences these impediments, he thinks that he has reached his goal. He thinks that it is the end of his practice. And so he stops there and he does not go any farther. So when he does not go any farther, and this is not the end of his journey, it is just some side effects he experiences during the practice. So when he stops there, his progress is blocked. So that is why these are called impediments of vipassana. So they are not the right path of vipassana. A person who has no prior knowledge of this may take them to be his goal. But a person who knows about these, or who has prior knowledge of these, that they are not the real goal, but he has to overcome these, then he will practice farther and will be able to overcome or transcend these impediments of vipassana. Stage of purity is called purity of knowledge and vision of path and non-path. Simply it means understanding which is right and which is wrong, which is the right path and which is the wrong path. Now, when these 10 impediments arise and a yogi is satisfied with them and attached to them, he is following a wrong path, because he will not make any progress after that. So these 10 impediments, the attachment to these 10 impediments is called known path. And understanding that these are just impediments and they are to be transcended, and the practice of mindfulness on these impediments is the right path, the right way to do. So understanding that which is the right path and which is not the right path is what is meant by purity of knowledge and vision of path and non-path. So during this stage, a yogi is confronted with this problem. Actually, and these 10 impediments, and if he does not go any further, then his progress will be arrested there. So understanding which is the correct way and which is not the correct way is the name of this this stage of purity. After transcending the impediments, he again sees the arising and disappearing of mind and matter. Now, at this stage, his seeing is clearer. His understanding is stronger. Now, you may have noticed that first he sees the arising and disappearing of mind and matter, and then he encounters the 10 impediments. And then he makes effort to transcend the 10 impediments, and he again sees the arising and disappearing of mind and matter. This time his understanding is clearer. So there are two stages of knowledge of arising and falling. Weak stage and strong stage. So the first stage is weak stage. At that stage, his understanding is not so strong, and so the impediments came in. And then he transcended the impediments, and his understanding becomes stronger. And so when his understanding becomes stronger, he sees more clearly the arising and disappearing of objects. After that knowledge, another knowledge arises, and by that knowledge he sees the falling or disappearing only. He does not try to see the arising. So his understanding is of, his seeing or understanding is of falling or disappearing only. So at this stage of knowledge, he sees whatever object he observes as disappearing. When he sees just the disappearing, on whatever object he keeps his mind on, that object disappears. So when he sees disappearance of the objects, he comes to the knowledge that the objects are fearful, they are dangerous, because they do not last, and they disappear as he observes them. So after that, he comes to a stage where he finds fault with mind and matter. When he sees that mind and matter are fearful, then he sees some. He finds some fault with it, with them. After seeing the fault with them, he becomes disenchanted. That means he turns away from mind and matter. He is dispassionate with mind and matter, or he becomes wearied with mind and matter. Now he is seeing just the disappearing, and so he knows that they are fearful or dangerous, and he finds fault with them, and so now he becomes wearied with them. So when he becomes wearied with them, he wants to get free from them. He wants to get free from mind and matter, because whatever mind and matter he observes, he sees them disappearing. So he wants to get free from mind and matter. That means he wants to get free from suffering. Number 9, knowledge is called Mucchitukamyata Jnana in Pali. Now there are two spellings for this word. The first is with two C's, and the other is with Nya and C. N and C, and with the tilde above it, and C. So the first is pronounced Mucchitukamyata, and the second is pronounced Munchitukamyata. So when it is Mucchitukamyata, it means to desire to get free, desire to escape. But when it is Munchitukamyata, it means desire to let go. They mean the same thing, actually. So when you become disenchanted with something, you want to throw it away. So you want to let go. So desire to get free or desire to let go, both are correct. When the yogi wants to get free from nama and rupa, or when he wants to let go of nama and rupa, he contemplates on them again as impermanent, suffering, and not soul. So he, at this stage, he tries to see the nama and rupa as impermanent, suffering, and not soul again and again. Then, as a result of this comprehension, he reaches into another stage of knowledge, which is called equanimity towards nama and rupa. That is equanimity about formations. That means when a yogi reaches this stage, he doesn't have to make effort to be mindful of the object. His mind is always on the object, and so the mindfulness, as it were, comes to him automatically. So he is not concern about mindfulness, because he doesn't have to make effort. Mindfulness comes to him by itself. So that is called equanimity towards mind and matter. So his mind is very calm during this stage, and his mind can stay in the middle. That means when he comes across some fearful objects, he will not get afraid, and when he comes across some objects, attractive objects, he will not be attracted to that object. So his mind will be in the middle. And also, he doesn't have to make effort. His mindfulness is always good and on the object. So this is a stage called knowledge of equanimity about formations. When his knowledge of equanimity about formations become matured, he will get into another stage of knowledge called knowledge of conformity. At this stage, he is about to get enlightenment. And that knowledge is called conformity, conforming knowledge, because it conforms to both previous knowledges and the knowledges which are to come. After the knowledge of conformity comes what is called knowledge of change of lineage. Now, from the second part of knowledge of arising and falling up to this knowledge of conformity, there are how many knowledges? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So these 9 stages of knowledge are called purity as the way, which is knowledge and vision, or we can just say purity of the way, purity of the practice. So these are collectively called. After the knowledge of conformity comes the knowledge of change of lineage. At this moment, at this knowledge of change of lineage, a yogi is about to get enlightenment. So this moment is his this moment is his last moment as a worldling, as an ordinary person. When he gets into the next stage, he gains enlightenment. So this stage is called the change of lineage. That means overpowering the Putujana lineage, overpowering, or we can say transcending the lineage of worldling and reaching into the lineage of a noble person. And this knowledge, a knowledge of change of lineage, takes Nibbana as object, while the previous stages of knowledge take Nama and Rupa, I mean mind and matter, or conditioned phenomena as object. This knowledge of change of lineage does not belong to the sixth stage of purity or the seventh stage of purity. So it is in the interim. But since it is in the flow of vipassana, it is called vipassana. So strictly speaking, knowledge of change of lineage is not vipassana, because at this stage the mind does not take the aggregates as object, but the mind takes Nibbana as object. So strictly speaking, it is not vipassana, and it does not belong to the previous stage of purity or the coming stage of purity. But it is in between vipassana stages. So since it falls into the flow of vipassana, it is reckoned as vipassana. Now, the knowledge of equanimity about formations, knowledge of conformity, and knowledge of change of lineage, these three are called insight leading to emergence. Here, emergence means prat, because the next moment is the prat moment. So these three are said to lead to the prat or to emergence, and so they are called insight leading to emergence. And next is the stage of knowledge of prat. That means it is the moment of enlightenment. So at this moment, realization of the Four Noble Truths arise, taking Nirvana as object. And immediately following the knowledge of prat is the knowledge of fruit. And this is the fruit of the prat, and so it is called fruit, phala in Pali. After the knowledge of fruit, after the intervention of some thought moments, there arise in the mind of yogi the knowledge of reviewing. That means he looked back to what he had attained, and also he reviews his defilements which he has eradicated and defilements which are remaining. So normally a yogi, after gaining enlightenment, reviewed the path he has reached and the fruit he has reached, and the Nirvana he has realized, and then defilements that are eradicated and defilements that are remaining. So there are five kinds of reviewing knowledge: reviewing path, reviewing fruit, reviewing Nirvana, reviewing defilements eradicated, and reviewing defilements remaining. Now, the seventh stage of purity as knowledge and vision, is the name of the knowledge of path, Magajnana. So, I think there should be a line under that. Knowledge of path. It's difficult to put another line here in on the computer, so you'll have to do it by hand. So there are seven stages of purity to go through in order to gain enlightenment, and there are different kinds of knowledges. Now, if you look at the chart, you will see the numbers 1, the knowledge of defining nama and rupa; 2, knowledge of descending causes; 3, knowledge of comprehension; 4a, knowledge of rise and fall; 4b, knowledge of arising and falling; knowledge of descending causes in the chart; 3, knowledge of comprehension; 4a, knowledge of rise and fall; 4b, knowledge of rising and falling, the same thing, rise and fall. And then 5, knowledge of falling only; 6, knowledge of fearfulness; 7, knowledge of faultiness; 8, knowledge of disenchantment; and 9, knowledge of desire for freedom; and 10, knowledge of recomprehension; and 11, knowledge of equanimity about formations; 12, knowledge of conformity; 13, knowledge of change of lineage; 14, knowledge of path; 15, knowledge of fruit; and 16, knowledge of reviewing. So there are 16 kinds of knowledges connected with the practice of Vipassana meditation. Among them, in the In the Abhidhammata Sangha, only 10 are called vipassana knowledge. So those are marked with numbers after them, like 3, knowledge of comprehension. Now there is 1 after the word sammasana jnana. So from the knowledge of comprehension up to knowledge of conformity, there are 10. So these 10 knowledges are called vipassana knowledges. And knowledge of change of lineage is, strictly speaking, not vipassana knowledge, and so in that book it is excluded. But in the commentaries, the first 2, knowledge of defining nama and rupa and knowledge of discerning causes, are also called vipassana knowledge. So according to the commentaries, we can say that there are 13 vipassana knowledges, from 1 to 13, knowledge of change of lineage. Number 14, knowledge of path is not knowledge of not vipassana knowledge, because it is beyond or above vipassana. And 15, also not vipassana knowledge. So now we know in theory the stages of purity and then different kinds of knowledge that arise during the practice of vipassana. So it remains for us to experience these different kinds of knowledges through the real practice of vipassana meditation. Thank you.